The big advice I give to sellers is the market will determine the value of your business better than anyone on this panel, better than you, the seller, better than any individual buyer. We have thousands and thousands of buyers, and for most businesses, we get multiple offers. That's the market.
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Dast. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
What would you say if a guy walked in for an interview without a shirt on and I hired him? What would you say?
He must have had on some really nice pants.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
So Mark, one of the privileges that you and I have as owners of Quiet Light Brokerage is that we have a unofficial board of directors in highly, highly successful entrepreneurs that are our advisors slash brokers. And we joke often that, you know, most of them are more experienced and smarter and more successful than we are. And I think, you know, with the panel that you put together in this upcoming episode, it's absolutely true. We've got Jason, Brad, Amanda, and David all sharing their experience as advisors, brokers, about how to be a good seller and beyond that with the entire transaction. How did the overall panel go? Did everybody behave and give nuggets of wisdom throughout the whole podcast?
Well, naturally, I started this off. First of all, it was a pretty interesting idea. I was talking to Amanda about going to a conference down in Austin where she lives, and she was invited up onto a panel, and she said that she'd be really interested in doing stuff like that. So I thought, why don't we do a panel here at Quiet Light and bring forward some of the advisors that have been working on deals? I mean, I think the combined number of years on that panel alone was something like 40-some-odd years of experience combined.
As advisors or entrepreneurs?
I didn't even get into the entrepreneur. I have no idea how to calculate that. That'd be a much bigger number. My math abilities stop after about 40, 45.
Okay. Gotcha. Right. All right. So everything is 40 years of experience for you.
I'm 42. So yeah, everything is, right. That's going to be the limit. Every year I add one number to my math abilities. The panel was pretty fun. I didn't know how it was going to go. I didn't know if it was going to be too many people on the panel. I was hoping for some discussion between them, and we did get into that. We got some great discussion between people who have been doing this for a really, really long time. I wanted to keep the topic pretty simple and just kind of dig into their actual experience in doing deals. I wanted to find out, what have they seen on the sell side specifically in working with people, humans, that can really influence a transaction by their behavior? How much have they seen that actually come into influencing the price? You know, and Jason, right out the gate, is like, look, we can sometimes influence the price, but the bigger worry here is having a binary effect. If you're a crappy seller, you might make this an unsellable business. You know, and that kind of launched off this conversation of what is it, how can you be a good seller? How do you balance this idea of being a good seller who's open and proactive? David talked about being proactive as a seller. How do you balance this proactivity and openness versus being a pushover, right? What elements should sellers also not necessarily open up on their business right away? And where should they stick their foot down and say, you know, we shouldn't be sharing this? Pretty interesting conversation on that front to see what other people's experience was in these different questions that came up. I did lead out right away, Joe, just to let you know, I asked them to pick either you or I moving forward for the company. And I won't tell you what the result was of that. But
So I have to listen to this to get the answer. What was the question again specifically? And what wise-ass comment did Jason make? Because I'm sure that's exactly where it came from.
You're going to have to listen.
All right. What was the question, though?
The question was, choose Joe or Mark. Go.
To do what? And you're like hosting the podcast, so you could totally edit it out and tell them no, choose me. So
it's
for the audience, I want you to know Mark has full editing control of the podcast, so whatever negative things said about him were completely edited out.
Well, that's actually not true. I don't touch it. In fact, there's a point in there, and I'm hoping the editor
sees
it.
He's fabricating. He's making this up. It's totally true. He works with Chris and Podcast Motor. They do what he tells them to do.
They'd be the only people in my life that do what I tell them to do.
You're married with seven children. That's just the way it is.
I guarantee nobody in my household does what I tell them to do.
Wait till they're teenagers.
There is a point in there. I hope the editors catch this where Amanda cuts out and I awkwardly interject. So we'll see if the editors catch that part. If they don't, just bear with it because she's actually giving some really good advice during that point in the podcast. So
you and I always joke about joke about the fifth pillar. You always correct me and tell me it doesn't exist. And for those that don't know the pillars, it's growth, risk, growth, transferability, and documentation. And I always say there's a fifth. It's an invisible fifth, and it's the person behind the business. Who you are and how you behave and what you post on Facebook and what your LinkedIn profile says and silly pictures and things of that nature, it has an impact on the overall value of your business. People are going to stroke a check for enough money that it's going to make a difference in their life savings and the risk they're going to invest in their future. They need to like you, number one. They need to trust you, number one. Both are number one. That is so, so valuable. So I love this topic. I absolutely have to listen to see how quickly they all said your name instead of mine. And then I'm going to have to, have another panel on with the other four advisors and see what they say.
Sounds great. Okay, welcome everybody. We're having our very first podcast panel or panel podcast. I don't know what we want to call this, but basically we have a bunch of people on this podcast here. We have Amanda, Jason, David, and Brian all joining me for a conversation. We've never done this before, so we're going to see how this actually works out. The format's going to be pretty simple. I'm just going to ask questions and pick out different people and see what sort of conversation comes from those questions. So guys, I'm just going to start off with a very simple question. You got to pick one person to lead QLB, me or Joe? No, don't answer that. I'm just joking. Don't answer that because I already know what the answer would be. You guys would want Joe. All right. So I want to focus this panel on more seller questions, right? Because we obviously work with buyers. I know a lot of buyers listen to the podcast, but we work with a lot of sellers as well. And so I want to focus a lot on that, right? What is it like to sell a business? What are some of your experiences? You guys have a ton of experience working with sellers, preparing their businesses for sale, helping them go through that really difficult and emotional, complex process of exiting their companies. So I wanted to try and tap into your collective wisdom here, get some good information and insights into sellers in that process of actually selling a business. And I want to start out by looking at how much influence a seller can have on the value of their business just by how they act with their business. So I'm going to start with you, Jason, because you are the longest tenured member of QLB here. So I'm going to start with you. I'm going to ask you just a pretty basic question here, and that is, do you think that you can increase the amount of money? Can a seller increase the amount of money they get out of the exit of their business by being a quote-unquote good seller?
Absolutely, 100%. But it may not be in the way that you're thinking about it. I don't know that your value goes from $1 million to $1,000,001 because you're a good seller. I think it's more binary. I think it's either $1 million or zero. Meaning, if you're not a good seller, I think it's likely to spook a buyer to the point where they simply don't want to complete a deal. So I think it's incumbent to be a good seller, to be ethical, to be honest. Very, very important to be transparent. So like any little thing about the business that might, in the back of your mind, you think, gee, I really don't want to talk about that. That's exactly the thing that the seller should talk about with the buyer. Get it out there.
Yeah. Amanda, I know, over the years, you've also been with QLB for a really long time. We've worked with all sorts of different people. Some people are really easy and a joy to work with. And while not dumping on any previous clients, some people are a little bit more challenging. And, I want to take a step back and just say something real quick. When we talk about challenging clients, difficult people to work with, the one thing that's always important for us to keep in mind is I get why some people are somewhat challenging, right? They've built a business, they have a valuable asset, they want to make sure the deal goes through well. So they have a right to a certain extent to be a little bit more challenging. But what has been your experience, Amanda, when you've dealt with a client that might be a little bit more difficult to work with and maybe a little more abrasive in the negotiations? Have you seen that impact the deal that they're able to get?
Absolutely. I think it's important to actually take those clients and, take them aside and say, it's really important to look at the feedback that we're getting from buyers, and to be reasonable with their expectations. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to be able to move forward with the deal successfully, because buyer's feedback is super valuable. If we get a lot of feedback that's consistent and a seller is not willing to hear it, it makes it very difficult to take those items that could be actionable, make them happen, and then get a deal done. I think that also working with abrasive sellers can certainly rub buyers the wrong way, because obviously after a deal is done, they have to work with the buyers have to work with the sellers for an extended period of time through training and support. And it certainly is concerning if a seller is not easy to work with and has a difficult time getting along with the buyer or anybody for that matter. So yes, it definitely can impact the deal.
Yeah. And I think, Jason, your point about it being somewhat binary, I think is interesting. You know, and at the end of the day, obviously, we're valuing the business, not necessarily the business owner. And so, Brian, I want to get your thoughts on what Jason was saying as far as it being somewhat binary. Do you agree with that? Or do you think that the seller is just one other element of the entire business mix? Obviously, we're valuing the business on its own to a certain extent. Where does the buyer fit in? I'm sorry, where does the seller fit into that entire valuation process?
Yeah, so I think Jason makes a really, really good point. And I'd like to touch on his point about honesty first, if you don't mind. I think that's probably the most important quality that a good seller can have. But in terms of the sort of being a good seller, being more binary than affecting the valuation, I think it can be like this, and if the seller is really difficult to deal with, then this can certainly result in a deal not happening. But I think that being a really good seller can actually also increase the ultimate value that the seller gets out of the transaction, because simply because being likable and getting along well with buyers is, in my opinion, likely to induce better offers, induce better conversations that lead to better offers, and thereby can lead to better and more profitable deals for the seller himself.
Yeah, I think, you know, the element here that I would just, if I'm going to comment on this here, it would be that, you know, a buyer is going to look at a business and look at the element of risk, right? There's always that perceived unknown of what am I actually getting into here. And if you have a seller who is shifty, if you have a seller who's maybe withholding information or is being, you know, just kind of, I think, Jason, to what you're saying, if they're being really abrasive or just mean or whatever, yeah, that becomes a very binary sort of situation where if I'm a buyer, I don't want to get into that because who knows what's going to happen after the sale, right?
But I find in the real world, though, it's not necessarily that a seller is abrasive. It's more, the word you used is good, shifty. A buyer just gets the sense there's something that the seller is not telling me. Are they planning to start a competing business the day after they sell? Do they know that this industry is about to hit a brick wall? Are they, you know, are there issues with the supplier? It's that shifty element more than the abrasive element is what I find in the real world.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, the thing that I think people on the sell side need to understand is that from a buyer's standpoint, risk plays into evaluation, perceived or real. It doesn't matter if the risk is real. If it's perceived, it's still there, right? And so if you are giving off a sense of risk to a buyer, that's going to play in the valuation that you get. So I guess you can put this out there as a plea to be a good seller, right? To behave correctly. But what does that actually mean to be a good seller? David, I'm going to throw it over to you because I haven't got you in on this yet. And sorry, I didn't get you in on the first question here. But I want to ask you, what are some ways that you've seen from sellers that make them good to work with and things that maybe sellers can do to maybe reduce that element of risk, that perceived risk from that they might give off otherwise?
Yeah, it's a great question. For me, it comes down to three core principles, and the guys have touched upon perhaps the most important one right away, which is honesty. And then after that, I think it's diligence and knowledge of your own business. And to the extent that they understand their own numbers in great depth, they understand the reasons, the trends, the way things have happened, the problems that they've had, like fully understanding the business. When you have that and have someone with that level of knowledge come on the call with a buyer, it's incredibly reassuring that they have this grasp of knowledge about their own business. And then to accompany both that, you know, depth of honesty with expertise in their own business. And you know, that's not taken for granted, because sometimes many entrepreneurs are running multiple businesses and they haven't had the time to focus a lot on one specific thing. So when you have that knowledge, it's really helpful. And then the third piece, of course, is proactivity. I think that it's easy to come into a selling process, perhaps when you're quite emotionally spent, if you've been with the business for a while, and to underestimate that, you know, a lot of buyers will ask some questions and they will want to go back into, you know, past historic information, and having like a positive mindset about pulling that information and realizing that it's all for the benefit of the ultimate end goal of the transaction, which is to get the best deal terms. You know, going at that from a like very proactive and positive perspective really just creates that like perfect cluster, I think, of the bestseller, like proactivity, positivity, honesty, and diligence.
Yeah, that can be a really difficult line to draw, right? Because from a seller standpoint, you hear some of these questions and you think, I don't want to share this, right? Yeah. But at the same time, you don't want to appear shifty. I mean, where do you guys think that line is for a seller when they're going through, especially like initially, right? We put a listing out to market. I think Brad, who's not on this call, recently put a listing out to market and had like 300 inquiries on it, right? We had to shut things down. And you know, that client is going through multiple calls, one after another after another. And some of these buyers get on and they start asking some pretty pointed questions pretty quickly. Where do you think the line is? Amanda, I'm going to throw it to you. Where do you think that line is where between being shifty yet still open and honest and proactive, as David says? Because I agree with you 100%, David, that being proactive makes a big difference. So where would you put that line, Amanda?
I think it has to do with creating expectations for when you're going to open up certain information and letting them know upfront what you're comfortable with. So, you know, there are certain things, obviously, that you want to keep pretty close to, like your suppliers or, you know, certain proprietary information that you just don't want to open up to everybody. And so possibly you say, okay, I'm going to give you all of this information, my financials, you know, this is how I do this, this and this, but creating a timeline of when they'll have access to that information based on certain steps being in place in finalizing the deal. And keeping some of that information towards the end, I believe, has worked really well for most sellers and buyers. Because if you have that trust level that you built between the two along the way, and then you're just, you know, basically following the course of actions that have been set out ahead of time, then I think that that creates a nice flow. And obviously, that's what we want. We want sellers and buyers to both be comfortable through the entire process so that we can get to that finish line. And so I think it is obviously definitely a fine line. But also, when a seller and a buyer are working together and they're meeting in person, I think that makes a huge impact in what information is shared, because you can just feel whether a person is trustworthy or not and what they're going to do with that information. It often comes across just an energy. And so oftentimes the seller will let their guard down just when they get to know the buyer a little bit more. But upfront, I think obviously you don't want to give 300 people everything you have for obvious reasons. So
yeah, and I think for the
creating expectations.
I would agree 100%. And for the buyers that are listening to this, I think the insights that you can take away from this as well is understanding that, Amanda, your suggestion and something that we use quite a bit here at Quiet Light during the due diligence process of ordering your requests and understanding some items are going to be more sensitive than others is a really good tip there. It does a great job of helping that seller get put at ease. And from a sell side, it's a great way for you to protect your more sensitive data by promising it, saying, I'm more than happy to share this with you, but let's first go through these other items first, just in case that torpedoes a deal. Brian, I'm interested to know what your thoughts are, where you think the most sensitive sort of data is that sellers might want to consider maybe safeguarding a little bit more than others. Obviously, different sellers have different levels of comfort, right? Some don't want to share a single thing about their business, other people are like, I don't care. You can't replicate what I did because I got the magic sauce, right? What sort of information do you think sellers is kind of the main stuff you would probably want to hang on to until the end?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it depends a lot on like you said, an individual seller. It also depends a lot on the type of the business and the business model to begin with. So I think with an e-commerce business, the most closely guarded secrets, so to speak, might be like Amanda mentioned, the vendors. With any business that depends entirely or for the most part on a single or a couple traffic sources, the seller might hold the details of those traffic sources confidential, such as for instance, in the case of PPC traffic, they might not feel comfortable disclosing their full keyword lists and ad copies and so forth in the early stages. So it really depends on the business model. It also depends on the business itself and how defensible the business is. Like you said, there are some businesses and sellers who are happy to open up absolutely everything because they're fully certain that nobody can replicate the business no matter what they tell them. But businesses differ and sellers' comfort levels differ.
David and Jason, I'd be interested to know from you, are there any elements that you have ever run across that have been off limits in a due diligence process? And if so, how have you handled getting around that? For example, vendor names, customer names, talking to employees. If you're able to share any details on that, please do. I didn't prep you for this, so if you're not, we'll just move on to the next question.
No, it's fine. Well, one thing, if I may, I just want to add on to what Brian said. You know, he mentioned about whether a business is replicatable. One thing sellers hopefully are aware of, any buyer that's going to see the information has signed, I think it's about a 5-page non-disclosure agreement, which specifically says they're not allowed to scan for ideas to steal. So if a buyer did that, they would be blatantly violating their NDA and a seller would potentially have legal recourse. So hopefully that would give sellers a little more comfort. In regards to what information is truly off limits, the thing I found is by the time of closing, it all has to come out, but some of it does come out essentially at the closing table. So one of the big areas of sensitivity I found is if a business has employees, a lot of times the seller doesn't want to mention the sale to the employees literally till the last minute. The reasoning is it could really make them panic and look for other jobs if the deal doesn't go through. The buyer who might be inheriting these employees will have some obvious consternation. They're going to want to know who's about to work for them. Are those people planning on sticking around? That could be a really sensitive area. And I've had situations where it feels like gridlock on that or some other small issue. And it always seems to get resolved at the closing table at the 11th hour when finally everyone feels confident that the deal is actually going to happen.
Yeah. And I think to add to Jason's point, something that comes to mind a lot for me over the years after having a lot of SaaS deals is you can imagine the code base is just a really core secret source component of SaaS business. And the buyer very naturally wants to see that, annotate, see what the kind of code quality is, annotations, and see what the kind of architecture is. And that, creates a lot of fright naturally in the owner right away. And it was an interesting bridge trying to think about how we could do that in a very safe way to get to that point that Jason's talking about, which is the eventual reveal at closing. And what we did that's worked very effectively over the years and what we do at QuietLight is show a snapshot of that code base and just provide enough insight and then a high level like architectural look so that they can see how the sort of modules are put together and then just a small snapshot so they can analyze the code base on a very discrete basis, or also consider using a third-party due diligence advisor to come in and review the code base. And that way, the owner's never really hands-on with it. It's being reviewed by a third-party specialist, and there's a non-disclosure agreement in place. And so you really can actually go into something that looks like quite a difficult issue, something to verify, with a lot of credibility and integrity. So that's one of the ways that we've managed to do that with SaaS.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've learned over now 13 years of helping people through this is that during the due diligence process, oftentimes a buyer comes in and says, I need to understand X. And rather than saying that in the due diligence process that I need to understand X, they say, okay, I need to understand X. And the way to do that is Y. And so what they say is, let's do Y. And the seller says, I can't do Y. And then the buyer says, well, what are you trying to hide? Right. And so one of the tricks for you guys that I know you guys have done so well over the years is figuring out what is that X? What is the person actually trying to achieve through this request? What are they trying to learn through this request? And David, to your point, I'm glad you brought up software because I was going to bring that up. That's one thing that I would consider to be kind of a non-negotiable. Like if I had a SaaS business and a buyer came in and said, I need to get the code base, I would say no. I don't think that that's reasonable, mainly because we can satisfy the same information that you're seeking in a way that does not involve handing over the entire code base through a third-party due diligence request or otherwise. I think there are other elements that could be non-negotiable, such as if you have a business that has only 5 clients, right? And if the buyer wants to speak to those clients, there might be a reasonable request there, but it can also be pretty dicey. And so how do you overcome that sort of friction in a due diligence process? Jason, it looks like you have something that you want to add on to that.
Just touching on that, one thing we were talking about earlier was being a good seller, and the corollary is being a good buyer. One thing I've encountered on occasion is somebody will have experience with having done other deals in the past, either business acquisitions or dispositions or real estate or something. And a person might have an attitude of, I've done a lot of deals. This is the way it's always done. And one message I would try to get out to people is, just because you've done a deal in a certain way, that's not the way it's always done. You know, this panel has done literally hundreds of deals and probably in dozens and dozens of different ways. So I think, Mark, what you're saying is try to figure out the core want and then get creative about how to supply it is probably the most appropriate answer rather than being rigid and saying this is how it has to be.
I also think to David's point about bringing a third party to do due diligence and possibly a financial audit or an audit of some technology or code, it brings a lot of value because it gives the buyer some time to focus on actually what they want to do with the business going forward. And it takes that the nuances of the financial load, you know, because it's so tedious when you're going through financial due diligence or looking at code. Have somebody else do that who's professional and experienced with that, while the buyer can focus on, you know, future opportunities and getting prepped and ready for transitioning into the business. And I think there's a ton of value in doing that. And oftentimes it helps the seller feel more comfortable sharing that information with a third party as well.
I'd be curious to see what experience each of you has had with conditional purchase agreements. I've used them sparingly. And just, I'm going to take a step back. Whenever we do the podcast and I introduce something that is a little bit outside the normal, oftentimes I hear from you guys and others saying, oh, why are you saying that? Now everyone's going to want a conditional purchase agreement. So I'm not necessarily encouraging this, but I've used it on occasion when somebody really doesn't want to disclose vendor names or really doesn't want to disclose something else, right? So we say, all right, let's put together a conditional purchase agreement where basically this thing is binding, conditioned on a very specific term. Have any of you others worked with those? No?
I think like I said, I've had some deals where it really seems like it's either going to close or fall apart at the closing table, and they've always closed. But it's always whatever's that one condition has been revealed right at the very end.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to wrap this up. Amanda, I think one point that you made that I kind of went right on over is meet in person. If I could give one bit of advice to anyone doing an acquisition on the buy side or sell side, get together and meet in person. It solves so many problems. If you can spend a couple of days with that person in the same room going over some of the due diligence materials, I think it solves a ton of problems, or it creates a massive problem and the deal shouldn't happen anyways, right? And that's an outcome that might be okay if the deal is going to be bad anyway. And so meeting in person is a great suggestion and something that I would definitely recommend. All right, I'm going to move into another topic here. Brian, I'm going to move this over to you here. And that is talking about what's important in a negotiation. Okay, when somebody is looking to sell their business, oftentimes what we do is we think, I want to get money out of this, right? I want to get X out of it. I want to get as much as I can possibly get out of it. And then forget that there's a lot of elements that you have to negotiate. You have a non-compete agreement. You have maybe an employment or consulting agreement on top of that. And there's literally, you know, probably about a half dozen different things that get negotiated through the process of selling an online business. What are some areas that you've seen maybe a wrong emphasis from sellers in the past where they might put too much weight on one element of a transaction?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on in terms of what makes an offer than just total price of the offer. There are things you mentioned. There are seller notes, earnouts, equity roles. You mentioned an offer can be structured in so many ways. In terms of wrong emphasis, I think sellers are often a little bit perhaps too much against carrying a seller note, especially if it's a small seller note. I've seen this sentiment changing over the recent years, though, and it used to be the case years ago that most sellers would basically only want to deal with full cash offers. It's now getting more and more common for sellers to be okay with a 5, 10, 20% seller note. And the reason why I believe sellers should be more okay with carrying small notes is because, and that's what I often explain to sellers themselves, is that oftentimes those offers that they get that are structured this way are actually going to award them more money at the end than a full cash offer would, to the extent that they can even easily consider the seller note to be sort of a bonus on top of what they get anyway. So they can keep pushing for an all cash offer, but it's likely that this all cash offer would actually going to turn out to be lower than the cash part of the offer that might include a small note.
Yeah, you know, to that, we have a podcast, I think probably would have aired a couple of weeks before this episode here, with Shannon Stewart, who's a tax advisor on the sell side. And she has an example of a business that sold for $11 million in which she was able to the net proceeds increased by 43%, largely through deferring some of the payments that came in. And when you're talking about $11 million deal, 43% increase in net proceeds is not a small amount of money. So I would agree, seller notes and knowing how to structure those the right way is something. Jason, what would you say? Is there any element that you think sellers tend to overemphasize when they're negotiating?
Yeah, I mean, I think like Brian said, headline price gets a lot of focus, when in reality, it's more about how much are you going to get over time after tax that you get to keep. And then I think another thing that gets way, way too much emphasis is multiple. I think a lot of people get hung up on multiple, both buyers and sellers. And it kind of boils down more to bragging rights than to a discernible business reasoning, meaning, oh, you know, I sold my business for 4X or whatever, so I can tell my friends. The reality is, okay, let's say you push the multiple for your particular industry. Let's say you're selling an e-commerce business and they normally sell around 3x earnings, and you manage to push it to 4x, but you're taking a lot more risk. To get to 4x, you had to accept an earnout, and you know, it's dependent on performance and this and that and the other. Even if you collect it all, you're earning what you would make in 4 years anyway. You wouldn't be selling the business if the sole reason was the money that you're getting paid. There's clearly other reasons. Otherwise, you're better to keep the business. So the big advice I give to sellers is the market will determine the value of your business better than anyone on this panel, better than you, the seller, better than any individual buyer. We have thousands and thousands of buyers. And for most businesses, we get multiple offers. That's the market. If you're not willing to accept what the market will bear, you're better to keep the business than to sell it, or to try to push the market beyond what it will bear, because it very likely could backfire.
Well, Jason, you're begging me to go into the question that is also on the list. I'm not going to go there yet because I want to stay on this one here, and then we're going to get over to that question to wrap things up here. David, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this as well here. Are there elements, I mean, you've got a ton of experience in working with sellers, just like everybody here. What are some things that you see people often negotiate maybe more heavily than they should, and
What advice would you give to them on that?
Well, I think certainly on the emphasis question, I would say to sellers when they're reviewing any offer that 50% of the decision, only 50% of the decision should come down to purchase price and terms, and the other 50% should be based on the execution certainty of the buyer that's actually presenting the offer, because there's an ocean of difference between coming out with an LOI for your business and actually closing it. And I think it's part of the a huge component of hiring a broker and an advisor to help you take that bridge from there to there. And I think it's, for me, sellers that have been really receptive to guidance and advice at that point, where they've managed to take the focus off the headline price, off the headline multiple, as Jason was talking about, and consider the wider context of, is this deal going to close? Because the buyer has experience, for example, they have a readily available source of funding, their due diligence requests aren't, you know, miles and miles long, they're not, you know, reliant on any kind of outside financing or external sources. All of these things introduce risk into the deal. And ultimately, that's risk that, you know, needs to be looked at properly in the context of the whole deal. So I think that's really important. Negotiating terms, you know, one thing that I always recommend for sellers to be open to is the prospect of keeping the window open for like minority kind of consulting arrangements after the sale. Obviously, we hand off every business through a standard, you know, transition period, and depending on the size and complexity, that can vary. But I think one thing that's actually really good for sellers to think about is maybe, you know, staying on to do like an hour or two a month for just say 6 months longer with the sale. And that goes a huge way with buyers, knowing that they just have a slightly longer line with the owner to ask, you know, a half an hour long question in 4 months' time. And to that point about getting the trust and getting the deal over the line, that's a huge point that I think sellers are sometimes like, they're spent and they don't really want to spend more time in the business, but just that tiny little time investment for just a few more months goes a huge way towards getting the deal over the line at a great value.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that 100%. I remember when I sold my business now a long time ago, they asked me to stay on for 6 months afterwards and they paid me for it. It's a regular monthly consulting fee. And at first I was like, oh man, this is going to be a pain. But what I found pretty quickly is it wasn't. It was really easy. It was very easy money that I was bringing in as a result of that. And it really helped with their transition as well. All right, we're at 35 or about 30 minutes here on this. So we're going to round it out with one last question. And this is one that is pretty important to me, because I think for what we all do here, right, we all earn a living in some capacity through helping people exit their businesses. And from our standpoint, it can be really easy to treat people's businesses as inventory that we're simply moving, right? And obviously, we don't ever want to go there, because we're all business owners ourselves. We've all been through that. You know, we know what work it takes to build these, and then how difficult it can be, how stressful it can be to sell them. So one of my pet peeves that has grown over the years is just hearing people say, oh man, this seller, I was approaching them. I wanted to buy their business. You know, they weren't selling it, but I was doing outreach and I asked them how much they'd sell for. And man, his expectations were crazy. It's a pet peeve of mine. So I'm kind of implanting here the answer that I want to hear. Amanda, we're going to go left to right on my screen. Amanda, you're first here. Do you think that there is such thing as an unreasonable valuation, or is there only really unreasonable expectations of what the market can bear?
I think both, actually. I think unreasonable expectations for what the market can bear. I mean, we're seeing that right now. Certainly, we've seen a lot of growth in multiples over the last 2 years, and there's been a push to constantly drive that multiple. And I think we've done a really good job of doing that. But sellers, of course, have their own expectations on what they think the multiple should be, because they hear things from other sellers, or they, you know, possibly got an offer 4 years ago from a strategic and they decided to pass it up, and that has dried up and gone away. Is no longer a viable option. And so I think the market evolves really quickly. And so I'm actually one of those people who may have unreasonable expectations, professional with expertise and proper data to bring, you know, a seller like that back to reality. And I think that that's actually the core of it, is having realistic expectations with what the market is, you know, the ability of the market at this time, because obviously that may change in 6 months for better or for worse. I think that whether the expectations are unreasonable is less important than the seller being able to be open to the feedback and coming back down to reality. I think that makes a lot of difference, because we see that quite often where sellers will come in and they think their business is worth, you know, X multiple, but then they're open to hearing, you know, what we're experiencing, what we're seeing, because we do a lot of volume, and then, you know, having those realistic expectations is super important.
Yeah, and I think the one thing I've been trying to remind people as well, especially on the sell side, when we get up into the high seven and eight figure territory, you brought up, Amanda, that, you know, a seller might have gotten an offer from a strategic years ago, but obviously never went through, or they heard about so-and-so who got, you know, a 6X on their business. What they never really hear when they hear these big prices is what was the composition of that offer, right? How much was there actually cash? How much was equity that can be phantom value? Jason, I know you have a lot of stories about phantom values in equity, right? And so that's something that we don't hear about. It's like the sports contract of, oh my gosh, they got $120 million, but it's only $10 million guaranteed and like so much in incentives. Jason, what are your thoughts on this aspect of unreasonable expectations on the part of sellers?
I think part of it depends how you define unreasonable, because I'll look at myself as an example. Most people say I've got very unreasonable expectations of the value of an hour of my time, and I will concede absolutely positively. What I expect to earn is way more than what my job will provide, and all that means is I need to adjust how I use my time in order to achieve it. So if you're a person who believes your business is worth a lot more than the market will bear, that's perfectly fine. I just think don't be a seller, because the market won't provide it. It's important to understand that people on the other end of the transaction are buyers. They're seeking a certain rate of return. They're comparing your business not only to safe alternatives, to a spectrum of alternatives in various safety like bonds, stocks, municipals, real estate. They're also comparing it to other businesses for sale that earn roughly the same amount and might have roughly the same growth plans. And it can be really frustrating if anyone is banging their head saying, no, my business is special and deserves more, when the market simply won't bear it out. I think most of us on the panel have kind of learned that there's a range, there's a spectrum where evaluation could be within a certain range depending on certain factors. Sometimes it's worth it to test the market, to put out something at a bit higher valuation, just as long as the seller understands that the odds are going to go down the harder you push. And that the one other kind of important point I want to bring up, we talked about this on an internal email the other day. A lot of times a seller will call multiple brokerages. They'll call Quiet Light and then two or three of our competitors. And that's perfectly fine. We want you to talk to whoever you want to talk to. But one common thing I'll hear is a seller will say to me, how much is the business worth? And I'll quote a price. I'll say, I think it's worth about, you know, $1 million for the sake of argument. And they'll say, well, wait, I just talked to brokerage X and they quoted me $1 million too. Can you get me $1 million too? My answer is, I don't know, and neither do they. It's not the broker that's buying your business. It's a buyer that we've not yet identified. And all of us are doing is giving an opinion. And in some cases, it can be really detrimental to the seller to try to play brokers off each other, because the broker's tendency might be, well, gee, if these three other people told you it's worth more, maybe I'm wrong. And the price gets bid up in the seller's head. And then when you get to market, the buyers, the people that are actually writing the check for the business, are like, what are you talking about? You're way out of bounds. So it's really important to remember who's the decision maker. In my mind, the decision maker is always the person that's writing the check for your business. Sometimes that's the buyer. Sometimes that's the banker who's funding the buyer. But you always have to cater to that ultimate decision maker to figure out what's the true value.
Absolutely. So in regards to the value of your time, Jason, I appreciate you putting me on a payment plan for this little podcast panel. Because it is pretty crazy. All right, David, over to you. I want to get your opinions on this.
I think Jason said it absolutely the best. I think the market ultimately informs everyone. And to pick up on what Amanda said, it's all about receptivity to that. I mean, you can continue on as a business owner with a maybe like aggrandized perspective of the value of your business for a long enough period of time, and as Jason said, potentially go with a broker that's, you know, gone for a particularly inflated valuation. The problem is, as Jason and we all know here, is that if you come out way too high, you will flop in the market, and it will be a long, long, long period of time before you then eventually have to come off exclusivity, wind down the listing, and then return back to market at a later point in time, often with another advisor. And how many times do we see that at Quiet Light with people coming to us from, you know, Broker X or whatever, having spent an awful lot of wasted time? And to go to Jason's point, all of our time is valuable. And we will have a perception of it. If you're a business owner with a great business that you want to exit, your time is especially valuable. So that decision right out the gate, in terms of your receptivity to what the market will bear, is arguably the most important decision when it comes to respecting your own time and getting a process done and completed and money in the bank.
I remember probably about a year ago, I was courting a potential client, and then he came back and said, another broker quoted me so that they could get me this much. And it was substantially higher than what I was what I was quoting him at. And he said, and he's going to reduce his commission to this. And I looked at it and I called him and said, yeah, you should sign with them. Because, I mean, how do you counteract that, right? And I couldn't really counteract that too much, other than say, if you really think they can get that and are paying less commission, then you should sign with them. He ended up signing with me later, and we ended up getting a really good deal for him. But I think your guys' point about valuations being a predictive exercise is on point. All right, Brian, save the best to last. What are your thoughts as far as this unreasonable expectations, or is it just unreasonable expectations for the market?
I think Jason and David both absolutely nailed it, and I'm glad that they took the conversation the way they did. I think the market is always going to be brutally honest, and any valuation mistakes are being made, any unreasonable expectations are going to be corrected by the market. But I think the one most important thing for a separate understanding is it is going to be the market who will buy the business. It's not going to be the broker. There's no point negotiating the valuation of your business with the broker, because it's not in the broker's power to value your business. It's the market that values your business ultimately.
Absolutely. I'm going to round this out and close it up by saying one thing, and that is, Jason, you said this in what you brought up, right? If the value of your business in your head is $10 million, but the valuation of the market is $1 million, don't become a seller, right? That's kind of the result. As far as like Quiet Light Brokerage, look, I know where the value of Quiet Light is. If somebody came up off the street and offered me the value, the market value of Quiet Light, I would say no. If they offered me two times the market value of Quiet Light, I would say no. If they offered me three times, I would still say no, because the value in my head for what this business is worth to me right now is way more than what the market value is. I'm not a seller, not going to be a seller for a long, long time, right? And that's totally fine, because I love this business. I love working with you guys. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast panel. Guys, give us feedback on this. Let us know what you think. If there's something that you want us to do a panel on as far as topics, let me know. If you want it to be specific to an industry such as e-commerce or SaaS or content sites, we can do that as well. We've got a wealth of experience here with the advisors, and would love to be able to tap into them more with these podcasts. So again, thanks to everyone of you for joining this. Let's do it again, hopefully sometime soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks
Mark.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light content team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.